this week's program, a conversation with the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Aaron J. Kernis. David Patrick Stearns profiles Anthony McGill, the principal clarinet of the Metropolitan Opera. Susan Lewis considers the 18th century German Baroque composer Georg Philipp Telemann one of the most prolific composers in music history. And Tom Keels explores the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia's commemorations of the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Aaron J. Kernis is among the most successful and prolific living American composers. The 51-year-old has written music in virtually every form except opera and ballet and has had work commissioned for many of the world's leading orchestras and foremost performers, including sopranos Renee Fleming and Dawn Upshaw, violinists Joshua Bell, Pamela Frank and Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg, and the guitarist Sharon Ibsen. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 1998 for his string quartet No. 2, Musica Instrumentalis. I spoke with Aaron J. Kernis recently backstage at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia. Is it fair to say that you are a melodist by nature? You write very strong melodies. Is that the starting point for you?
I like that you've mentioned that. That's a term I'm very happy with. And I do think first of line and of melody. And I was first a singer. I was first a choral singer. And I can say I've been most attracted by vocal instruments like the violin, the cello, things with a singing tone.
How do you know, and this is probably a really dumb question, how do you know when A, you're not repeating yourself, or B, you're not repeating somebody else?
Well, if I'm repeating myself, it's very clear, because I pretty much have in my build-up adult DNA, if there is such a thing, my works, I kind of hold them in my body in a way. And so if things come back, often it's deliberate. Occasionally a person will come to me and say, oh, you know, the tune in this piece is very similar. And a lot of times I'll use similar intervals that for periods of time, concentrate on particular motives that may turn out to be related. In terms of
unintentional borrowings, shall we call them?
I think more are intentional. As I'm going through the process, a lot of the agonizing in the process comes when I've written a passage and I say, you know, this sounds like Strauss, or this has some harmony like Brahms. And then I'll spend a few weeks thinking, can I? Get rid of it, keep it, you know. And I do both. Sometimes I'll throw stuff out for that reason, but more often than not, it's come out of a process. And it's usually fine if it touches on other composers' influences. And I hate to X stuff out when I see it come organically out of the musical process.
You say that, but I've kind of immersed myself in your music in the last 2 or 3 days, and I'm pretty sure now that I could identify an Aaron J. Kernis piece, blind-tasted, so to speak. Are you aware of what the Kernesque touch is? And do you ever have to do a great imitation of yourself?
You know, for many, many years, until maybe a few weeks ago, actually, I thought, do I have a voice? I'm not sure. Where is the voice? Because over years, I have different strands that appear. I have a strand of a jazz influence that appears, sometimes from the past, a pop influence, but more often, I think, a recognizable kind of melodic aspect and color, aspect of instrumental color. Those are the things I can point to, that they come in and out, they weave in and out of my work. And I had a residency at DePaul University in Indiana where about 2.5 hours of my work was played in 3 days. And then it became really clear. I mean, they did a lot of pieces that were choral pieces and vocal pieces, and the relationships were absolutely crystal clear. And they did fewer of the pieces that were kind of more radically out of that sphere. So I can kind of now say, yeah, you know, I think there is a bit of a consistency.
Finally, in terms of your overall arc of your career, do you feel that each piece you write is a progression? Is everything built on everything else?
I'm somewhat impatient, and I never enjoy doing too many pieces in a row that are like the last pieces. And so those similarities are inevitable, so I will do in between one big serious piece a lighter piece or something that's different, something that breaks the energy that was built up. And I think it's so I can stand back and breathe for a little while before plunging back into another related, usually more serious or longer or heavier work. So I see these different layers, and within each layer I think there is a kind of progression. I wrote my third symphony 2 years ago, and there's a way in which I feel my work has led to that piece. And I see it from time to time. When I start new things, as when I found the influence of jazz more prominently, that was a new thing. That didn't feel progressive from other pieces, but it felt progressive from my upbringing and from my background.
The Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, Aaron J. Kernes.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Anthony McGill left Philadelphia as one of the Curtis Institute's most promising graduates and has since established himself as one of the busiest classical clarinetists in the business. At age 31, he teaches at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, as well as at the Juilliard School. He plays recital engagements around the world, all the while working twice as hard as most orchestral musicians as co-principal clarinetist of the Metropolitan Opera. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns recently met with McGill at the Met.
It was dark down there, but the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra pit, home of many sublime sounds that support the greatest opera singers in the world, is, well, where do you start describing it? Well, for one thing, it's hazardous. Whenever the popular Bartlett Cher production of The Barber of Seville is on stage, there's some sort of an explosion that leaves clarinetist Anthony McGill showered with spongy little Smurf balls. During War and Peace, a net hangs over the orchestra pit to keep stray battle accoutrements from hitting the musicians. In Armida, the fog machine left musicians coughing. McGill is the last to know why. His only view of the stage is a fleeting glimpse of Renee Fleming when she's in the far right corner.
We have the worst seats in the opera house, the clarinets, bassoons. I sometimes strain and try to look up and see what's going on.
At least the pit is safer than the stage.
Well, that's the scariest, when you're in a dress rehearsal or something and all you hear is someone screaming, "Stop! Stop! Maestro, stop!" And you're like, what just happened? It can be very dangerous.
One thing he can see is who's in the audience. In fact, his view of the auditorium is something close to omniscient. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake.
Yeah, I can see the entire audience pretty much, except for the orchestra.
Even as far as the family circle, which is kind of halfway to Connecticut?
Maybe not that far. My neck doesn't stretch that far out.
McGill has come a ways from the south side of Chicago, Obama country, where he was raised by a high-achieving family. His older brother, a flutist, paved the way from the Interlochen Academy to the Curtis Institute of Music, where McGill studied with Donald Montanaro. McGill couldn't feel more affectionately towards Philadelphia. He calls it the city that got away, at least from him, because after Curtis, he had to go wherever he was hired, which happened to be the superb Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. Then, 7 years ago, to the Metropolitan Opera. As an African-American clarinetist in the mostly white classical orchestral field, he senses some racism about him. Then again, he also has the prestige of having played chamber music during the Obama inauguration. But he can't think too much about the extra musical reasons influencing why certain things have or have not come his way.
You have to go through, not really ignoring it, but kind of. You can't judge everyone based on what they may think. And if you are absorbed with thinking about what everyone thinks about you, one would be crippled.
It's hard to imagine anybody resisting his playing for any reason. His clarinet, in many ways, resembles a speaking voice. There's a smoothness and legato. A quality that he shares with his predecessor, Ricardo Morales, who went from being principal clarinetist at the Met to the Philadelphia Orchestra. Miguel has known Morales at least since he was 19, but if you ask him, his legato is one part of his playing that needs work.
What I actually am working on a lot is that teachers tell me not to swell on every note. You know, this is something that we wind players tend to do sometimes when we're trying to be more expressive. And what I'm trying to do is to sustain the expression through the phrase and over the bar lines, and like a string player pulling the bow across the string, and to imagine that the air is doing that. To tell the story, sometimes you can't get into every note individually. You have to actually tell the story over a series of 10 notes, 20 notes, or whatever, in order to communicate a sentence.
And at the opera, he's definitely in the business of telling stories, many of them quite long, stretching over 4 or 5 hours, though with the help of some of the greatest conductors in the business, starting with the Met music director, James Levine. The Met's guest conductors have also been extraordinary. Miguel has played under Riccardo Muti, Fabio Luisi, and quite recently, Simon Rattle, in the mysterious Debussy opera, Pelléas and Mélisande.
Rattle just changed my life. You know, I was unbelievable. Unbelievable. You have some experiences that are so vibrant, you feel like you're so present in a moment that can never be taken away from you. That's what this experience was like. It's like I carry it around with me. It didn't just disappear after we played the final note. It actually changed who I am as a musician, because, you know, the operas are long, so you really are going through some sort of transformation while playing this stuff.
With experiences such as that, the attraction of a possible solo career isn't that strong for Miguel. He recently recorded his first album, a lovely collection including the Poulenc Clarinet Sonata, and has a posh website revealing him in a very flattering light. But even though a solo career might be a logical step in a conventional career, Miguel is the first to say that an artist's life hasn't the usual goals.
Playing music is not like building a house. You know, you don't finish it. You don't have a concert that you say, well, that's done. It's never done. It's a process that is ever changing.
Still, his playing sounds so effortless, you wonder if it'll become too easy.
I never worry about that. It gets more difficult. When you get older, you start thinking more. And, you know, that gets in the way of everything. So you have to start practicing more so you don't think as much.
What a curious concept that your brain can be the enemy of making music. While the brain opens the doors of possibilities, it also closes them with fear, the source of all limitations. Besides, isn't musical performance an act of doing rather than an act of thinking? Particularly for clarinetists, the brain is just the starting point. And the rest? Well, I'll just keep my ears peeled to the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra pit to find out.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. German composer Georg Philipp Telemann reportedly wrote more music than any other composer in history, and during his lifetime was wildly popular. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the life, music, and mystery of this 18th century master.
I associate Telemann with his own unique balance of melody and virtuosity.
He wants to try everything that's possible musically. And so he became a master of every conceivable musical style.
He's absolutely a musician's composer.
For sure, musicians like Elisa Berardi and Bruce Becker, co-artistic directors of Philomel Baroque Ensemble, and flutist Mimi Stillman, artistic director of Dolce Suono Chamber Music Series, know and love the music of Georg Philipp Telemann. Yet his name doesn't have that household ring to it, like Bach or even Handel, both of whom were his contemporaries.
There's a long tradition of denigrating Telemann's music, partly because scholars in the 19th century put Telemann down so they could raise Bach up.
Stephen Zone is associate professor of music history at Temple University and the author of a book on Telemann's instrumental works. He says Telemann's popularity worked against him with musical historians.
People say, well, I mean, there's this mass of music that we don't have a real handle on, and how could it be very good?
Telemann's rise to musical power was also against the odds. He was born in 1681 into a family of Lutheran clergymen who were not at all eager to see Georg pursue a career in music. Instead, he was encouraged to study law, which didn't hold his attention very long once he got to Leipzig University. There, says Bruce Becker, he had opportunities to engage his self-taught passion.
He kept dabbling in music, and finally the floodgates just broke, and he became a composer.
And did he ever? He founded his own semi-professional orchestra. He took a series of court positions in Poland and Germany, was city music director of Frankfurt and then Hamburg. By the time Telemann died at the age of 86, he had composed around 3,600 works spanning every genre, from choral works and oratorios to chamber music, concertos, orchestral suites, passions, and operas. Stephen Zone says Telemann not only wrote a mind-boggling amount of music, he published his works himself.
He actually physically engraved it himself, paid to have it printed, distributed it to publishing agents all across Europe.
He was great at marketing. I think of him as the pop star of the Baroque era.
Alyssa Berardi says the historically accurate instruments on which Philomel plays are especially good at illustrating Telemann's mastery of the Baroque musical conversation.
A fascinating little gem is the trio in F major for recorder, viola da gamba, and continuo.
In writing for his diverse audiences of both amateur and professional musicians, Telemann incorporated influences from other parts of Europe as well. Flutist Mimi Stillman says Telemann developed a style known as German mixed tastes,
which is a blend of styles, German contrapuntal techniques with French and Italian styles, and even with Polish styles.
Rich with cross-cultural influences, the music also combines emotion and technique, says Stillman, pointing to the suite for flute and strings in A minor.
Not only is it happy, but it's very virtuosic for the flute.
Today, Telemann still occupies a back seat to his contemporaries, Handel, and especially Bach, who has emerged from history as an icon, celebrated in festivals, and played, copied, and adapted in multiple genres. But perhaps Telemann's time is coming. With scholarly interest in him and opportunities to hear him around the corner, more and more people may be taking another look at this 18th century musical sensation.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Telemann's work, Ino, a dramatic cantata for soprano and orchestra, can be heard next weekend in a program by the Philadelphia Baroque Orchestra, Tempeste de Mare, on Friday evening at the Arch Street Meeting House in Center City, and on Saturday evening at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill. Stephen Zone's book on Telemann, Music for a Mixed Taste, Style, Genre, and Meanings in Telemann's Instrumental Works, is published by Oxford University Press. The year year 2011 marks the 150th anniversary of the outbreak of the Civil War, the bloody five-year conflict that forged the modern United States. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores a new exhibition at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia that provides a deeply personal look at the events that tore America in two.
November 30th, 1860, was less than 3 weeks after Abraham Lincoln was elected president. John Henry Brown, a Philadelphia artist, had painted a portrait of Lincoln earlier that year and found that he liked the candidate personally. But, as he wrote in his journal that day, he saw Lincoln's victory as heralding America's doom.
A number of the southern states have already called conventions for the purpose of taking into consideration their separation from the North. It is now almost certain that this glorious union will be torn asunder and some of the brightest stars obliterated from the folds of the American flag.
John Henry Brown's diary is one of a number of artifacts currently on display at the Rosenbach's The Civil War Begins exhibition, which marks the sesquicentennial of the conflict. Catherine Haas is the show's curator.
The exhibit is called The Civil War Begins, and it's an exhibit about the causes and the lead-up to the war and then the initial conflicts, Fort Sumter through the First Battle of Bull Run, First Battle of Manassas in the summer of 1861. And in fact, we start looking at issues of slavery and also some of the states' rights issues that were brewing throughout the 19th century. We look at the rise of the Republican Party in the 1850s, and then we get full force into Lincoln's election and the aftermath of that.
The exhibition includes notes from Abraham Lincoln, written in 1857, in which he tries to establish a platform for the Republican Party, then only 3 years old. There are letters from the radical abolitionist John Brown, whose abortive raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859 has been called the First Battle of the Civil War. Also on display are documents describing the life and death of Colonel Elmer E. Ellsworth, the first Union officer killed in the war.
He was killed in May of 1861. He had gone into Arlington, and there had been a large, really large Confederate flag flying from the top of a tavern, and he went in, went to the roof, ripped it down, and then was coming down the stairs when the owner of the tavern came up and shot him.
Ellsworth became the first Union martyr of a war that both sides were sure would last only a few months. His body lay in state in the White House and New York City Hall before his burial in upstate New York.
It's not only an important event in and of itself, because it was one of these big galvanizing events in the early war, but also I think it's a reminder of the optimism and sort of naivete of this early war period, in which people had the time and energy to do all of this. I mean, when you fast forward to 1863, 1865, you're counting the deaths in the tens of thousands and the hundreds of thousands, and people thought that there weren't going to be that many casualties, and that this was a really singular event.
In conjunction with this exhibition, the Rosenbach has created a companion website called Today in the Civil War, which tracks the progress of the conflict through letters, diaries, and newspapers, posted 150 years to the day from when they were first written. The Rosenbach has also commissioned jazz musician and composer Dave Burrell to create an original musical work, Portraits of Civil War Heroes. Burrell, the Rosenbach's musician in residence, has drawn on its archives to paint musical portraits of four men: Colonel Ellsworth, abolitionist John Brown, Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and Union General Ulysses S. Grant. Burrell's music delves beyond the stereotypical images of these heroes. For instance, Robert E. Lee's portrait is not a military march, but a delicate, melancholy waltz. Portraits of Civil War Heroes is the fourth composition Dave Burrell has created for the Rosenbach. Having previously composed works based on modernist poet Marianne Moore, the Lewis and Clark Expedition, and the Bill of Sale for a Slave, Burrell, who performs the piece with violinist Odessa Balan, explains how his research helped to shape the nocturne for Robert E. Lee.
We wanted to make a definite distinction between Robert E. Lee's battlefield image and emotions and his personal feelings when he wrote letters to family and superiors. The letters that I read at the museum's reading room made it very evident to me that this is a man that was torn by war and very much a human being with feelings.
By contrast, Ulysses S. Grant's portrait is a march, but it's not a swaggering victory progress. It's the plodding march of soldiers returning to camp after a lengthy battle, exhausted but happy to have survived. Burrell draws on a wide variety of musical styles from different eras and countries. For instance, his portrait of John Brown consists of two parts, life and death. The life composition, depicting Brown's children playing with freed slave children, utilizes African tribal rhythms and American nursery rhymes. The death passage draws on traditional mourning music, but also incorporates unusual rhythms and sounds.
The dirge piece, the sad piece, has the heartbeat, the human heartbeat, and the intensity of the heartbeat, and then the lack of heartbeat at all, and church bells, and those clusters, and polytonalities represent the people that came to view the hanging, that were pro-hanging, and those that were against.
America is still divided by many of the same issues that split the country 150 years ago. Racial conflict, economic inequality, and personal freedom versus federal power. Visitors to the Rosenbach may gain some valuable insights into how the country addressed these issues in 1861 and how it can avoid the same mistakes in 2011.
WRTI's Tom Keels. The Civil War Begins is at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia through July 17th. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony NC under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.